This is a CBC podcast.
Hello, hello. Okay, great.
From the Canadian
Broadcasting Corporation.
This
is Spark.
This is Spark.
Technology.
Trends.
And fresh.
Fresh ideas.
Fresh ideas.
This
is on the air.
This is
online.
This is Spark.
CBC.ca/Spark.
Overturning expectations and flipping stereotypes, the surprising new direction of games, the trailer park goes glam, and hacking your high-tech camera, all in 27 minutes.
I woke up one morning and I knew immediately that things weren't right, and I actually happened to be at my cottage, and when I got up and went out into the living room, things just didn't sound right, and I started talking to my wife, and I couldn't hear what she was saying.
That's Mike Partridge. A while ago, he sent me a message through Facebook about technology in his life, so I called him up. Hi, Mike. How are things in St. John, New Brunswick today?
Wonderful. A little chilly, but a great day.
How did losing your hearing affect your daily life?
In a word, it was devastating. I couldn't understand, my wife, my kids. I couldn't use the phone. My wife and I ended up with her typing on the computer and me reading over her shoulder, which she hated. I wasn't prepared to cope with that, especially with happening so suddenly. It was no one was prepared really to handle it.
So how is Mike hearing me over the phone if he's deaf?
You're talking to me on the telephone. You wouldn't know that I'm deaf. If my battery dies right now, I hear nothing.
The battery is for Mike's cochlear implant. It's this electronic device, and it's really quite cool the way it works. Part of it is in his inner ear, and part of it is outside, about the size of a loony.
About the size of a loony, with a magnet in it that actually attaches to my scalp. And then behind the ear,
there's this mic that picks up the sounds around, Mike. And then there's a speech processor that selects the sounds from what's going on around him.
Hello, hello.
Then there's this transmitter, which changes the sounds to electrical impulses. And then there are these electrodes inside Mike's inner ear that send the impulses to the auditory nerves.
So, can you take me back to the moment when you first heard again after getting the implant?
The first thing that came to mind was beam me up, Scotty. So it was very funny at first. Voices in the beginning are very cartoonish, like people are speaking with helium. I walked around in awe, down, went for a coffee at Tim Hortons and just kept looking around and trying to determine what the sound was and where it was coming from, and I hadn't been deaf all that long.
How long were you deaf for?
A little over 3 years. I guess I was profoundly deaf. I really couldn't hear anything for about 2.5 years.
The cochlear implant doesn't restore Mike's hearing to what it was before or amplify it like a regular hearing aid does. But it does let those impulses get to the auditory nerve, and from there to the brain, which understands it as sound.
I'm back. I'm happy. I'm enjoying life. I have a power switch. When things are bothering me, and I sleep really well at night. It doesn't matter who's snoring or how loud. I never have a problem getting to sleep. I can't explain what it's done to me totally, but it's been just a superb experience.
It's amazing. What an amazing technology. So, are you a bionic man now?
I was thinking about that the other day. The original implant, like I have, they started calling it a bionic device. And back when the Steve Austin and the Bionic Man were on, that was very accurate. The implant itself is a tiny computer chip. It's underneath my scalp, and it's... there's a small electrode that goes right down into the middle ear. It's bionic. I'm a $25,000 man, I guess.
It didn't cost $6 million, thank heavens.
No, I'm a...
Well, it's a great story, Mike. Thanks for telling us.
Oh, well, thank you.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye.
The revamped version of The Bionic Woman launches this week on NBC, and of course that had me wondering whether she still has to tuck her hair behind her ear in order to hear bionically. Well, that little pop culture moment got us thinking about the technologies we use to augment body function, to make up for lost hearing or a lost limb, and just how far they could go. Kevin Engelhardt is Associate Director of the Institute of Biomedical Engineering at the University of New Brunswick. They're doing internationally celebrated research.
What we're working on is a control system that will be capable of allowing people to control the next generation of artificial limbs in a manner that's very intuitive and very powerful. So we develop, in the end, tiny computers that fit inside these limbs and interface the person's neuromuscular system and try to impart that control to an artificial limb.
Do I just think about moving my arm and then it moves?
That's the idea. At the moment, using remaining muscles, we do the best we can. If it's possible to get directly at the information from the nervous system, that information results from the thought process of moving the limb, and if it's properly recovered, you should be able to control an artificial limb in the same way.
I know that part of your work is with another team that's actually moving the nerves in the body. Can you explain that a bit?
The nerves themselves in an amputated limb are serving no purpose. One of the primary scenarios that we use are transferring to the chest muscles. So now the pectoralis muscles become essentially a surrogate site for what would have been the muscles in the arm.
So when I want to move my artificial arm, I would be contracting my chest muscles instead?
Exactly.
Right.
And if you look at the people who have had this procedure done, try to control the limb, you can see muscle bulges in the chest that correspond to fingers and the elbow. And it's a very bizarre but fascinating thing to watch.
Wow, that is really cool. How sophisticated do you think we can get with artificial limbs?
Well, there's been a very fortunate development in our field, which has resulted from unfortunate circumstances in the world. The conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan have prompted the U.S. military to invest a lot of money in both lower and upper limb prosthetics research. And we've been invited to participate in these large projects. So all of the parts seem to be coming together at exactly the right time.
So how close are you to developing a prosthetic limb that functions like an ordinary human limb?
Well, we've made some substantial advances in the last 3 or 4 years. So it's definitely on the horizon. We can see these highly functional limbs coming out soon with relatively easy and sophisticated control systems in them.
I wonder what our attitude to prosthetics will be once they fit more seamlessly into the way our bodies use them. Maybe we'll think of them more like the way we think about eyeglasses. How far could it go in the future? If artificial legs or arms are even stronger than biological ones, would using a prosthesis be thought of as enhancement? Join the conversation at the blog cbc.ca/spark or give us a call 416-205-8974. Now, sometimes technological aids can have surprising effects, as we found out in this reaction to a posting that we got on the blog from Ryan Knighton. Ryan's visually impaired, and he teaches at college, and to do that, he uses a computer screen reader.
Computer screen reader.
To read and grade his students' assignments.
I noticed after about a year of marking that my commentary was getting angrier, and I couldn't figure out why, because nothing had particularly changed. I just noticed that I was getting kind of more impatient or something. And then I realized that I'd been using the same voice for over a year at that point, and it seemed to me that in my own imagination that I'd been marking the same student repeatedly. And so what I do now is I change the computer voice slightly at the beginning of each semester to help refresh in my mind, or at least refresh my imagination, that I actually have new people in front of me, not just this one particular voice that doesn't seem to want to learn anything. And it seems to work much better. I'm a much jollier marker than I used to be.
Now, the latest hot innovation isn't always something high-tech. One trend I've been noticing is how many people are getting unplugged these days, going to lo-fi, intensely local meetups like knitting clubs or farmers markets. And I'm often surprised by the people who are doing this. You know, people I would have thought I could only separate from their cell phones by prying it from their cold, dead hands. Getting unplugged is happening in the game world, too. There's a whole subculture of people into what's called German-style games.
Wir streiten.
Because a lot of them are designed in Germany.
Es bleichet in des.
There are these board games that usually involve a bit of depth, but they're way easier and more social than games like chess. Over at Drexel Games in Vancouver, these people are deeply involved in a German game called
Snorta.
This is the game where you make noises. Everyone gets an animal. Once everyone has seen your animal and we've done a round sounding off, you will hide your animal inside your barn in front of you. I've flipped up a donkey. So I have the donkey. You have the duck.
I never used to play that many board games because I didn't think they were that great, but these new games have really exploded the gaming world recently. I remember years ago, maybe 5 years ago, when I started playing these games, almost no one played them. Now you come to this and there's like 30 or 40 people every night, and there's hundreds of people that are easily you can get together with to play these. So it really has exploded. They're very interactive games. They last from 60 to 90 minutes. They're very beautifully produced, but they're not complicated either, and they're very enjoyable. They're very social, but they still have a bit of an intellectual aspect.
Vancouver's Drexel Games has a German-style games night every Friday.
Technology.
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 Etiquette.
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 Etiquette. Wait.
Etiquette.
Is that how you say it?
Kit.
Etiquette.
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 With me, Tom Howell.
So, Tom, what's been worrying you this week?
I was using a friend's computer and her web browser was up, and I was sort of, you know, the list of all the sites that the person has been to recently, the history file. I was sort of interested in looking at it.
You looked at her web browser history?
First of all, I just asked some other people what they thought.
I don't think we can do that because it's somebody else's.
I totally agree with her, but if that happens to me, for example, my girlfriend's computer, I may look it up. I'm a curious by nature.
It's not good to do that. It's not polite, and then you can have different problems. So why argue with somebody? Why destroy something that looks very happy and very nice for a stupid thing on a computer?
If you have something to hide, you should be deleting that browser history and those cookies. You know what I'm saying?
People disagree quite a lot.
People do, Tom.
Yeah, why not?
I can't say that I would never, 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 100% ever, ever not do that. I mean, it would be tempting if it was the boyfriend or something like that.
I know it's wrong, but I might do it. It's just so easy to do, I guess. It's so accessible. However, learning from past experience, you're better off not knowing.
I even asked a professional etiquetter in Victoria, British Columbia.
Etiquetter?
In my opinion, it is considered disrespectful behavior.
Her name's Deborah Wakeham.
If you're glancing over someone's shoulder to take a look at their web browser or quickly taking a look while they sneak out of the room, that's really not showing respect to another person. And it's true, you know. We may find out things that we simply don't want to know. And we may find out things that are completely not related whatsoever to the person who we think that we're checking up on. And so it's just simply dangerous and disrespectful grounds.
I think it's quite interesting, though, to look at someone's browser history.
And therein lies the problem with so many etiquette questions, is it's actually interesting to do that.
Yeah.
Yes. You know, last week, Tom, I read that browser histories are showing up in divorce trials as evidence of marital misconduct. But anyway, I mean, I don't have a strong opinion on this. I know what you should do, but I also know that it would be, of course, it's tempting.
What should you do?
Not look at the browser history. What kind of an etiquette guy are you? This is definitely a question for the Spark blog. Have you ever looked at someone else's browser history? And if so, did you regret it?
Next week on Spark. This is interesting.
Tom, are you looking at my computer screen?
Well, yeah.
Didn't you learn anything from doing this column?
Not really.
Bye.
Bye.
As I was about to say, next week on Spark, we're going to look at designed deterioration. Why is it that some tools that you buy actually get better when they get broken in a little bit, like, say, a fountain pen, but electronics just don't? We'd like to get your thoughts on the agony of the first scratch. Like that time you came out of the shopping center to find your new car had been dinged. Or maybe you're obsessed with protecting your phone or your MP3 player from the dreaded scratch. Tell us your story at the Spark blog, cbc.ca/spark. And we also have a link to a really fascinating article on design deterioration. Pay us a visit and we hope you'll leave a comment. Now, a couple of weeks ago on Spark, we aired a piece on the ambient edition, the thingy that you wear that turns street noise around you into ambient music. And we got this email from David Sky.
I've been working with an audio editor called Audacity, which you can use to record and edit sounds. And I've been writing what are called plugins for Audacity for 4 years. One of the most recent plugins I wrote is called an audio selection sequencer. What you do is you create a brief piece of audio in Audacity. Then you use the sequencer plugin and you can turn your little piece of audio into a melody.
From the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, you're listening to Spark. Tech, trends, and fresh ideas.
cbc.ca/spark.
One of the benefits of digital technology is that it's putting all sorts of professional-grade tools into regular people's hands. But a funny thing is that sometimes that very same high quality makes us want to mess around with them. You might think do-it-yourselfers are trying to make the best quality tools they can with what they've got around them, but sometimes it's the opposite.
Now it's time for the Gearhead Shit. This week, photographs on the radio.
It's time for the Gearhead Shed with Pedro Mendez, except we're not in a shed. We're outside on location with the Gearhead. Hi, Pedro.
Hi, Nora. Yeah, we're sort of like in the back behind the shed, in the backyard.
Conceptually speaking.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, why did you bring me out here?
To take pictures, of course. No, don't worry. It's nothing nothing dirty. I'm going to show you some very simple homemade hacks that you can do to your digital camera. I love my digital camera. It takes beautiful pictures, but it always turns out really nicely. Like, all your pictures, you know what I mean? Like, the colors are always normal, and nothing weird happens.
In fact, a friend of mine takes digital photographs and jiggles the camera so that she gets a kind of little hyper-realistic kind of look to it.
Exactly, and it turns out there are tons of people messing with their digital cameras, and so what I've got...
we're not actually breaking the cameras here.
No, we're not going to break the camera, and the stuff that we're doing to it is not going to cause any permanent damage, and the pieces are all things that you can get either at home or at a hardware store for less than $10, and so anybody can try it.
Okay, so hold on. Can we put this stuff up at the website so that if people want to get an idea of what we're looking at?
We're going to post photos of all the stuff we're taking pictures of, but I'm actually going to put photos of all the little pieces so people can see what it is that we're actually using to make this happen.
Okay, cbc.ca/spark. So what do we do with that now?
First thing I'm going to show you is how to add a fisheye lens to your digital camera.
Cool.
Okay, so first, I'm going to hand you this. You know what this is?
I believe this is a peephole from a door that you look in to see who's in your hallway.
This is a $10 peephole that I got from a hardware store. And just the basic, just like you said, you put it on your door so that you can see who's at your door. So that's part one. The second part is a bottle cap from a 2-liter Coca-Cola bottle. Now, the reason I chose this is because it fits right over the lens of my digital camera. So that's why I chose this. And what I did to it is I drilled a hole in the top of the cap big enough so that I can actually screw my peephole into the lens, into the cap. It's like a protruding lens cap with a peephole on the end of it. Okay? Make sense?
Okay. Now what?
Now what I do is I turn on my camera, and when you look through the aperture...
Oh, that is far
out. So what you do is you zoom way, way in on the circle. You can see the sky above you. You can almost see your feet. Look at that.
Yeah.
You can see the people standing next to you, the people all around you. And one very cool thing to do with this is you get up here. I brought a robot. So come over here. I brought a robot that we can photograph. You get up nice and close to it.
Yeah.
And look at this. I'm like an inch away from this dude. Yeah.
It looks like a gigantic.
Look at this. Look at this. Okay.
Beautiful.
So keep having fun with it. Keep experimenting. Take all sorts of different photos with it. You know, you're in a normal situation. Take your normal picture and then pull out your funny little home crafts. Take pictures like that. And it's just, you're going to blow people away.
So we're going to post these to the Spark blog, cbc.ca/spark. And we have like a Flickr stream where people can upload their photos. Is that right?
Yes. I'm going to put some of my experiments that I've done with the digital camera. I've actually done some weird stuff with my cell phone camera. I'm going to put all of those there, and I would really encourage everybody to try this stuff or other hacks that they've come up with. Put them on the Flickr site and explain to everybody how you did it. Like, what stuff did you use to build it and to get the effects that you created?
Pedro, I have one last photograph that I think I need to take.
What? The robot again?
No, you know when you were demonstrating that to me?
Yeah.
I think a seagull pooped on your back.
Oh, God. No, wait. I felt something while we were talking. I thought maybe somebody had tapped me on my back, and I'm like, dude, I'm on the radio. Don't talk to me right now. But it does sort of still, the shirt still feels kind of heavy.
Come on, we got to put that up on the web.
Okay, take a picture of it.
All right.
Is it really bad? Oh, God. Is it on my pants?
This has been the Gearhead Shed.
The Gearhead Shed
with Pedro Mendes.
I swear, Pedro got so excited, he would not shut up. Maybe that's mean to say, but really, he would not shut up. There were like 45 hacks, so we had to cut it down, hack it, as it were. Visit the blog to see the hacks, and please post your own tips, cbc.ca/spark. One of the things we want to do on Spark is take a look at older ideas that have gone out of fashion, but are now back in black. This week, trailer parks.
Centennial Diary.
Sault Ste. Marie was invaded by 260 trailers over the weekend. The trailers are all part of the Wally Byam Cross Canada Caravan, which is taking close to 600 persons, most of them Americans, across Canada to Expo 67 in Montreal.
Back in the 50s and 60s, trailers looked like the wave of the future, inexpensive homes for a booming mobile population. But then, trailer parks fell on hard times, PR-wise, calling up images of tornadoes, lack of opportunity, and of course, trailer park boys. With that kind of reputation, can trailer parks ever make a comeback? Well, maybe they can with the help of some groovy design and the new booming movement in green architecture. Andy Thompson is a Canadian architect who's designed a self-sustaining mini-home. It's 3 meters wide and 11 meters long. It comes with solar panels, a composting toilet, and a roof garden or green roof. Now, technically, the mini home is a trailer, but it looks like a designer condo.
Look at any given suburban house, and you'll find that probably 90% of the time, nobody's home. People are out at work, the kids are doing activities, you're in school or whatever, so it's empty most of the time. Then you've got the micro aspect, where how much of the house is actually in use at any given time. Maybe you're in the kitchen at one time, and then you're in the dining room, and then you're in the living room watching TV, and all the other rooms are not occupied. So if you look at what you really need, that's what we've done here. So you've got the kitchen, you've got the dining room, you've got 2 bedrooms, you've got the bathroom. But you don't need all the extra space, and you don't need all the extra suburban infrastructure. That's where we started to connect the idea of this distilled single-family home in the context of a trailer park. And that's where we started to say, well, maybe this is the future of the suburb, where you're not ripping down all the trees and pulling all the soil away and stripping off the topsoil and putting in this heavy-fisted infrastructure. You don't have to have light standards that obliterate the night sky, but you can actually have starry nights. You can have natural rainwater infiltration of the ground. You can have a very nice community, neighborhood, organic layout, anything you like. Because we're striving to be off-grid, we're using about 1/10 the water, 1/10 the gas, and 1/100 the electricity. Some people say it looks like a condo. Some people say it looks like a bait shack. It's a very boxy-looking thing from the outside. Inside, we've really done the magic in here with bringing in lots of light from up high. There's a few double-height spaces. There's a loft that the kids can go up and sleep in. It's a very clean, kind of minimalist aesthetic with a lot of wood and natural finishes, so it's got a nice air quality to it. Sitting in the front, we can see all the way to the back. We don't have a limit of an 8-foot ceiling. We are going right up to 13 feet, so it feels spacious, even though it's fairly small.
Well, architects may think trailers can be cool, but what about the rest of us? I'm joined now by Patrick Condon. He teaches at the University of British Columbia, and he's the author of the Site Design Manual for BC Communities. He's in Vancouver. Hi, Patrick.
Hello.
So you heard Andy Thompson there. What do you make of the idea that trailer parks are the future of the suburbs?
Well, I'd rather think about the eco-home that's described as something that doesn't provide an alternative for the suburb, but is maybe thought of in the context of a new model for housing for the suburb, rather than thinking of trailer parks as these discrete places that are different than their context. Why not think about that whole idea of a small lot home, which is essentially what he's talking about,
right,
as the norm rather than the exception? That would make things much more affordable. The conditions he ascribes to the trailer park of being cheap infrastructure and very efficient land use should be universally applied to the suburb rather than regulated out of existence.
So why do you think there's resistance to that if it makes so much sense financially and environmentally?
Well, it's been something that's been building up as a kind of a cancer since the 1950s, where the suburban communities have felt that it was in the public's best interest to make lots ever larger and make roads ever wider. And the consequence of that is to make all that stuff much more expensive and to make land use much less efficient. that has been kind of embedded in a sense of, I hesitate to use the word class, but I'll use it in this sense, the feeling in suburban communities that it was upper class to have larger lots and therefore quite a bit of animosity towards any proposal that came forward with smaller lots.
And maybe if we make them cool, then it suddenly offers some potential alternative, I suppose.
I think the cool idea is pretty interesting because that's already happening here in Vancouver where people are very happily living in 500 square feet and thinking that it's the coolest thing on earth, just that they happen to do these trailer parks in the sky, in effect.
Right. Patrick Condon, it seems that cities have a problem. I mean, they want to stop suburban sprawl, so they put up apartment blocks, but they also want strong neighborhoods and to keep elements of the natural environment. How might small eco-friendly buildings like the Mini Home and others fit into resolving that problem?
There's been a lot of disastrous experiments with apartment living in North America that have failed. People don't know each other. They can't protect their own space. They can't police their own environment. So in answer to that question, I would say, yes, trailer parks provide a lot of the cues and signals that we should learn from. Let's take some of those better attributes of the trailer park and try to revise and restore a failing enterprise, which is the suburb.
Fascinating stuff. Thanks so much.
You're welcome, Nora. It was great to be here talking to your listeners.
Patrick Condon holds the James Taylor Chair in Landscape and Livable Environments at the University of British Columbia. I find it really interesting how often questions of stereotypes and how we think things ought to be are linked to questions of design, and how often good design is about questioning our natural assumptions. Like, why is a condo in the sky cool but a trailer isn't? Or why does not having a leg have to be thought of as a disability at all? Reminds me of a sign one of my high school teachers had up. Minds are like parachutes. They need to be open to work. Spark was made by Tom Howell, Elizabeth Bowie, Dan Meisner, and me, Nora Young. And by...
Mike Partridge.
My name's Kevin Englehart.
Her name's Deborah Wakeham.
David Skye.
Patrick Condon.
Brian Knighton.
Andy Thompson.
And...
Pedro Mendez.
Give us a call and let us know what you think of the show, 416-205-8974. Reach us by email at spark@cbc.ca or drop by the blog cbc.ca/spark. I'll be there. I hope to hear from you.
For more on all of our CBC podcasts, head to cbc.ca/podcasting.